Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for December 20th. I love the way everyone keeps trying to pick the bottom, whether it is in the equity markets or the economy. Let me simplify things for you. There isn't one macro indicator, not one, that is exhibiting anything of a positive nature worldwide, period. Manufacturing, hardly. Real estate values, I don't think so. Jobs, no. Consumer and business confidence, multi-decade lows across the board. Well, I guess there are a few positives, like falling oil prices, but this is tempered by the fact that the prices are falling because of demand destruction brought on by the plunging macro environment. One can certainly take solace in saving $20 to $25 a week on gas compared to just a few months ago, but that $1,000 to $1,250 annual savings hardly compares to the fear you could lose your $50,000 to $60,000 job and possibly your house. And while falling interest rates are a plus if you want to purchase a new home or refinance, here again there are more than a few caveats, like do you still have positive equity? Do you have a job? If you're buying a new place, can you come up with a 20% down payment that you weren't required to do just 2 years ago? What if you are a retiree? You thought you were doing everything right and kept a significant portion of your savings and equities because you were told that you live a lot longer than your parents did and stocks provide you with some upside to the portfolio, while using the fixed income portion for your everyday needs along with Social Security. But then stocks go down 40 to 50%, and the interest rate on your treasury bond and/or money market position has fallen to 2% or less, like zero. If you have a dartboard, I'm sure you've got Ben Bernanke's picture on it. Thanks for nothing, Mr. Chairman. So, no, there is zero reason to turn positive when all big picture items are still trending down. So when will I become more optimistic? When anything, like, say, business confidence in Germany or France ticks up 2 months in a row, where we have more than 1 month of improving news on the state of manufacturing in China. Or maybe it's Barack Obama and his stimulus plan, but we await details on this one. That's what I'm looking for. Until then, however, this is such a different time for the world that old-school narratives such as stocks anticipating a recovery 6 months before the actual economy turns up don't fly with me. And I maintain, as I've been writing for the past 2 months, that we can't begin to know anything of a truly positive nature until mid-February at the earliest, even if our new president wows us on January 20th. Noted economist Martin Feldstein, one of those who officially decided we formally entered recession in December 2007, said this week on CNBC that we are in the midst of a very long and very damaging downturn. PIMCO's Mohamed El Arian said, "The numbers are frightening around the world." Just look at Singapore's exports, for example. They tumbled a whopping 17.5% in November, while deflation has become a watchword, such as in the United States and China. Speaking of China, as it celebrated the 30th anniversary of the economic reforms initiated by Deng Xiaoping, there were heightened fears of massive unrest as the mainland's economy falls off a cliff as fast as anywhere else in the world. The state is worried about hordes of unemployed, such as migrants who have lost their jobs and can't return to their rural villages, or new college graduates unable to find work. And with prices tumbling, including for real estate, the chairman of the China Banking Regulatory Commission told a forum the economy was, quote, very likely to slide into deflation mode. Deflation was certainly on the mind of the Federal Reserve as it slashed the target funds rate to 0 to 0.25%. We never thought we'd be like Japan in the 1990s, but we're basically there. For its part, Japan lowered its key rate to 0.10% from 0.30%. Ben Bernanke and company, in their accompanying statement, said the Fed would use, quote, all available tools, close quote, to combat the crisis and preserve price stability. When it says all available tools, it means just that, including a statement that it is evaluating the benefits of purchasing longer-term treasuries. Earlier, the Fed had said it would purchase $600 billion of mortgage-backed securities, and it's barely begun doing so, though the market has already priced this significant event in. Yes, the Fed is prepared to do everything to get the economy moving again and to combat deflation. Recall, all year I've said inflation is not an issue, but so many have wasted their breath on this one. What about all the money flooding the system, they cry. Spare me, I've been writing. We'll have time to deal with this at the appropriate moment. But when you have a consumer price index that falls a record 1.7% for the month of November, I think we have a problem of a different sort on our hands. I mean, remember earlier in the year, even though we've since learned we were in recession, when some were talking about inevitable wage pressures. Try wage cuts these days, as in FedEx's announcement. It was slashing salaries, except among hourly workers. That's reducing them, not raising them, folks. That's deflation, as is what's happening in retail this putrid holiday shopping season. I can't imagine what the bargains will be like by February in the malls. I'm actually getting kind of excited by this prospect. But there are some other specific issues that were front and center this week, like energy. Oil traded down to the $34 level on the expiring contract. A new one now takes hold and will open around $42 on Monday. So in 5 months, 147 to 34. And this is after OPEC announced it was reducing production another 2.2 million barrels per day on top of a previously announced 2 million barrel per day cut. So you'd think prices would have rallied sharply, right? Wrong. It's all about compliance among OPEC members, or in this instance, lack thereof. All of these nations are desperate for every last dollar or euro, and it's each nation for itself. Plus, non-OPEC Russia, Norway, and Mexico said they wouldn't help OPEC out. Now, Russia has issued conflicting statements, but trust me, they aren't reducing production further when existing levels were already in decline due to lack of investment in depleting fields. Yes, demand is crumbling around the world, including in China. Consider that back in January of this year, the U.S. Energy Department forecast that worldwide demand would be 89 million barrels per day in 2009. Now that estimate has fallen to 85.3, and it's undoubtedly headed lower still, even as projects of all kinds are shelved and existing wells shut in. Peak oil enthusiasts, take note. Be patient. Our day will come again, just not yet. But one item is on my mind as much as any other these days, and that's Russia and its imploding economy. Industrial production fell a stupendous 8.7% in November. Contrast this with our own decline of 0.6% for the same month. Russia's once mammoth foreign currency reserves are being bled dry, and the Kremlin, similar to Beijing, is beside itself with fear over unrest, thus a growing crackdown, as I spell out further in my foreign affairs section. The issue on the energy front, though, concerns the now annual tiff over natural gas and the key pipeline that traverses Ukraine into Western Europe. Once again, Ukraine and Russia can't agree on a price, nor on the size of the debts Kiev owes to gas giant Gazprom. Ukraine paid off $800 million in arrears this week, said it would pay another $200 million shortly, but Gazprom and the Kremlin, which is pulling the strings, said Ukraine owes another $2 billion just for November and December. For its part, Ukraine has a real political and economic crisis, aside from the gas mess, and it's setting up for a classic Russia-inspired coup in the humble estimation of your editor. I mean, talk about an economy that is tanking. Ukraine said its GDP for the month of November was off over 14%. That was 14% in 1 month. And the GDP for the first quarter could decline another 10%. So watch this one, the next 10 days in particular, because there's a January 1st deadline on the natural gas situation. And then globally, there's the currency issue, one that threatens to take the place of protectionism in terms of a cause of depression. Smoot-Hawley killed us in 1930, The currency markets could do the same in 2008-09. Thanks to the Fed's moves, the dollar collapsed its worst week in some 15 years. More than half the gains in the greenbacks since the summer have been erased, and as other currencies strengthen, it's doing a number on their exports as they become more expensive. I have long argued that the dollar is not an issue, and way too much talk has been wasted on the topic. But today, yes, it's a genuine concern. Recall, just about a month ago, the developed nations, meeting in Washington after the election, issued a statement that said none of them would adopt trade policies that could be hurtful to the others. Cooperation was to be the order of the day. And it was, for a brief spell. But now it's everyone for themselves on the currency front as each nation attempts to protect its exports. Over time, this could mean the United States has to push interest rates back up, as the world demands a higher return to keep its dollars invested in the U.S. As for the auto industry and the Bush administration's lifeline, it appears to be the best of a set of poor choices. It's a short-term bailout of $13.4 billion for GM and Chrysler, with another $4 billion available in February. The two car makers must reduce their debt by two-thirds. The UAW must become competitive with foreign competitors manufacturing autos in the U.S. from a compensation standpoint, and GM and Chrysler must prove their viability as ongoing businesses by March 31st. Ford is confident it can weather the storm and didn't request any funding at this time. But there is no doubt the Obama administration will rewrite the plan upon taking power, so this was a way for the Bushies to kick the problem down the road. With Chrysler idling all 30 North American plants for 30 days, though, and with some of these facilities never reopening again, you can't help but wonder what the shape of the business will be come April. It's not just GM, Chrysler, and Ford with major issues, after all. Honda, Toyota, and Nissan have many of the same problems. This week, Toyota says delaying a plant opening in Mississippi, while Honda's president said, "The environment is worsening day by day, and we see no sign of recovery." Lastly, earlier in the week, economist Martin Feldstein blasted Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson for constantly changing his mind on the TARP. Sure enough, once again, Paulson did just that in allowing TARP funds to be used to bail out Detroit. Personally, I can't wait for January 20th. Stocks finished mixed for a second straight week as the pace of trading slowed ahead of the holidays. Activity should be minimal the next 2 weeks, at least, in terms of volume. The Dow Jones lost 0.6% to close at 85.79, but the S&P 500, in advancing 0.9%, completed its first two-week winning streak since September. NASDAQ rose 1.5% to 1564. On Thursday, stocks lost ground when S&P issued a negative outlook for General Electric, saying its AAA rating was at risk over the coming years. Not that we didn't already know this. By the way, U.S. Treasury yields continue to hit all-time lows. The 10-year is at 2.12%, and a 30-year fixed mortgage with Fannie Mae is now at a record 5.19%, though given more normal spreads with Treasuries, it should be closer to 4%. The Fed certainly hopes we get there. And finally, the Bernard Madoff debacle. This week, SEC Chairman Christopher Cox said, "I am gravely concerned by the apparent multiple failures over at least a decade to thoroughly investigate the allegations or at any point to seek formal authority to pursue them." No kidding, Christopher. But we won't have Mr. Cox to kick around anymore, even though some of his predecessors are far more to blame than he in this instance. The bottom line is it may take up to 6 months before we have a true sense of the losses caused by Madoff's Ponzi pyramid scheme, where new principals paid out to old investors, on paper or through redemptions. And when redemption requests skyrocketed beginning in the summer, the gig was up for Bernie, that we managed to hang on until the other day. SIPC, which can pay out as much as $500,000 to defrauded individuals, but may not be able to for literally years, is going through the books. Two sets that Madoff maintained, and the agency said they are in com- in complete disarray. Among the bigger losers are Banco Santander, the largest in Spain, the Royal Bank of Scotland, HSBC, and Nomura, let alone high-profile figures such as Jeffrey Katzenberg, Steven Spielberg, and Mort Zuckerman. But the biggest tragedy lies with those individuals who had their life savings with the dirtball and the Jewish charities that have now been forced to shut down. While details will be trickling out for months to come, one thing is clear. The feeder funds, the funds of funds, were prime culprits in that they directed tens and hundreds of millions, and in the case of some banks, billions, into Madoff's vehicle without doing the proper due diligence, the most obvious aspect being to look into Bernie's little three-man audit shop, the principal of which cannot be found as I announce or as I record to you today. Some of the hedge funds, fund of funds, such as Tremont Group and Fairfield Greenwich Group, placed 100% of their assets in certain funds with Madoff. For example, one of Tremont's vehicles was all in. $3.3 billion of $5.8 billion total it had under management, while Fairfield had $7.5 billion of its $14 billion in total assets and 100% of some funds with Bernie. These are the same shops that purport to do the due diligence to pick the best managers and levy fees on top of fees, though in the case of Madoff, he didn't charge a fee himself. Instead, he made his money through his trading operation, or so we assume. One individual's really being singled out, aside from Bernie, that being J. Ezra Merkin, chairman of GMAC and head of a $5 billion money management firm, now closed already. $1.8 billion of that five, of which was the Ascot Fund that had all of its money with Madoff, including that of Zuckerman, who had 10% of his overall charitable trust assets in this case. Madoff and Merkin were also involved with Yeshiva University, were both headed up the investment committee for the school's endowment. It's all sickening. And the tentacles range far and wide, as will be increasingly clear. What's worse, it could have been stopped long ago, and even those who were fortunate enough to get out before the scam collapsed, some with solid gains, may have to forfeit some or all of their money if it can be proved it was earned illegally. After all, anything over the actual investment was largely a fake paper profit. Well, that's our review for this time. Merry Christmas to all, and I'll be back with you the weekend of December 27th.